Hello and welcome to the Tavern Chat podcast. I'm your host, Dark Tankar, and this is another in the Designers and Makers series of Fireside Chats. With me today, I have Joshua Dissa of Genius Loci Games. Josh, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tanker. I've been looking forward to doing this.
Well, we both have, as we discussed prior to recording. We've been like ships in the night doing flybys or sailbys, I guess. Never quite getting our schedules right. Mostly my fault. So I'm glad we got this together. Welcome.
Thank you, and yeah, totally.
Right. So as I explained before the show, we're gonna start out with five questions that I ask pretty much everybody, and I've noticed that. Sometimes these five questions can take over 30 minutes to be answered, and sometimes they can take about five. Well, yeah, it just depends on where it goes. I don't care either way, just as long as we get some nice answers. So your first one, and it's going to be basic, but tell us about your first role-playing game experience. What brought you into the hobby?
So initially, I had been working at a CVS in high school. There was a guy there named Mikey, mid-20s, and he was always talking about Fast of Star Trek and Magic, not Magic, Vampire, the Masquerade. And that got me initially interested. But I was in high school, I didn't have a car, and this guy lived pretty far into the boonies, so I was never able to take him up on any of his invitations to go and play with him and his friends in a barn, although that really always sounded so cool.
It does, actually.
So when I was in AIT in the Army, we had two former actors who were also there, same MOS as me, and they started talking about it. And then I got this, it was a gold box, but it was ripe, it was after Wizards of the Coast bought D&D, but before third edition came out. And it was a basic game. It came with dice, it came with a play scenario, which all I could remember from it was it had the treasure with a dagger with a silver dragon hilt. Can't
Okay.
remember anything else about it. And so I picked that up just because it was on sale at the PX for like $10. And one of the actors, actually both had played, but one of them used to be a DM. So we hid this box behind our wall locker, well, my wall locker. And after lights out, we'd be there with flashlights on, like little kids on the floor playing D&D. This was 1999. So that's where it started from. And then after that, it was just experience in the Army after experience in the Army. So, I ended up playing with a Master Sergeant who had been in since the 80s, who played basic. That was where I first encountered racist class.
Okay.
And then, another, and then when I was in Iraq, there was a guy playing first edition who, honestly, we kind of broke some rules. We were playing over military radio channels after everyone went from the main base in Kuwait out to wherever they were going in Kuwait and Iraq. And from there, it was after I got out of the Army, it was playing with my brothers, where a lot of my experience came from with third edition, and then playing online games with virtual tabletops with people I had actually met, like on Xbox Live when it first came out. So,
Wow,
yeah.
that's an interesting way to get into the hobby, and the fact that you had to play after lights out, hiding it basically is great. I love that.
Well, after I graduated, like we graduated AIT, I was waiting for the bus to take me to a plane to do my free 20 days of leave before going to my duty post. I told my drill sergeant about it, and I asked him, why this had been, would have been illegal. because all we knew was we weren't supposed to have it. And he told me it all came down to the fact that there was dice. If there had been no
Makes sense.
dice, it would have been okay.
You know what? That makes a lot of sense, because dice could be gambling, God forbid.
Precisely. So I just was like, well, there's like 1d6. I don't know how we're gonna play well,
Craps.
thank you, craps with a d20. Actually, now I could probably find a way, but back then I couldn't.
Well, you probably, I guess you could have done it with a D6 and a D12, reading the D12 as a D6. Wouldn't have been easy though. I know friends that play craps. I've never quite figured out the strategy behind it, so I don't know.
It's always been a mystery to me. And I worked security at a casino for 2 years and I watched people play it, and it just, I don't know.
Yeah, okay, so I you feel my pain on that one. I to be honest with you, my first experience with craps was my first day on a foot post as a cop in the South Bronx at night, watching people in March play craps up against the wall of a housing project building. And all I knew is that if they were playing craps and I walked by, they should pick up the dice and wait till I left. And once they started doing that, I was like, I don't know what the game really entails other than people exchanging money and making lots of noise. But I'm assuming that's how it is in the casino too. People, money gets exchanged and people make lots of noise.
Honestly, the craps tables were the quietest tables. Poker tables, roulette table, every other table, loud. The craps tables, like everyone went silent as soon as someone had those dice in their hand.
Okay, superstition, I guess.
I suppose, but I'm going to tell you're in New York. I'm originally from Pennsylvania, Scranton area. Those guys are
Okay.
dedicated playing in March. I mean, that's dedication.
Oh, certainly. And listen, my parents have a place up in Hawley, up in the Poconos, and it gets really cold up there at night because the elevation you get down to negative digits. I know they did this winter, but that was a cold night that I was out there. It was, I know it was in the, I don't know, like mid-20s, and to see about a dozen people all huddled to roll dice on a cement sidewalk up against the building of a wall was interesting. And it wasn't even a weekend. It was like, I don't know, like a Wednesday night. It was like, if this is what you're doing on a Wednesday night, I can only imagine what you guys are doing on a Friday or Saturday night.
Yeah, but it's Wednesday. You need that. That's the what's that? The hump day. You need that relief.
Yeah, that's true. And maybe it's best to gamble before the paychecks come in on a Thursday or Friday. So you know what you can afford to lose because it's left over for the week.
This is true.
All right. Well, you've dabbled in a number of systems, especially early in your gaming career, we shall call it. What's your go-to RPG system these days?
Actually, the system I play the most is fifth edition, just because that's what's really easily available. And with three young kids in my job, I jump into what I can. But my personal system is still Swords and Wizardry, and then a little bit of
Okay.
D6.
Yeah, I like the West End Games D6 system. I enjoyed it in Star Wars, and I enjoyed the open D6 rules. It's just they're flexible and they're easy enough to understand, and you can kind of make them as complicated as you need, or at least as granular as you need, I guess. But the basic mechanics are just simple to grasp.
Yeah. Do you know they're from Honesdale, or originally were from Honesdale?
Well, here's the thing with West End Games. West End Games was originally in Manhattan. So I think 28th Street, something like that. I know that because I play tested Hill Sector Blues. I still have my play test stuff that was printed out in a block matrix, and that was interesting. But when Manhattan rents are disgusting, so they moved to Honesdale. That was the old Scholastic building. Scholastic Publishing. That was where Scholastic was when they moved to Honesdale. I didn't realize that they were in Honesdale until literally like a week before they closed shop. I was like, oh my God, Western Games is out in Honesdale because my parents had a place in Holly. So literally a 15-minute ride. And I was like, all right, well, next time I get up there, I'm going to have to check in. And then it's like, oh, wait, they closed shop. God damn it.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I didn't know about Manhattan. That's really
Yeah,
interesting.
no. Yeah, when I because when Paranoia first released, they had an office in Manhattan. And I'll be honest with you, when I say an office, I'm using that word very loosely. The office was maybe twice the size of my bedroom. And this is a New York house, New York City house. Bedrooms here aren't large. They may be 12 by 12 or 12 by 14. It was maybe twice that size. Desks were literally crammed up against each other. So when we play tested, it's not like you, not like they had a play test room. You sat on the desks of others. I think Ken Rolston ran us through the play test. And it was me and two of my buddies from my gaming group. It was a Friday night in Manhattan. And you didn't enter the building through the front. You entered through a back door to a service elevator.
Oh, wow.
So it was a Manhattan address, which certainly looked good on paper, I'm assuming, but wasn't a great office. But again, Manhattan rents, I don't blame them.
Oh,
But
God, no, even in the 80s.
yeah, so that was interesting. That was very interesting. And of course, when I got my Paranoia box set, it didn't come with dice. It was supposed to come with those two dice, and it came with nothing. And this is again in the late 80s. Dice were everything, man. Dice were expensive. It's not like today where you can get a bucket of dice for like $19 on Amazon. So I sent my letter into West End Games, and I got a letter back from Ken Rolston, apologizing for not including the dice. And then in the middle of the letter, the computer breaks in. And I'm basically told to turn myself in for treason because obviously there were dice and the computer makes no mistakes. So I didn't get dice, which I was hoping to get in the mail. I didn't get dice in the mail, but I got a letter from Ken Ralston in character that was priceless. Even back then, I realized that was worth more than dice.
Oh, hell yeah. That is awesome.
Yeah, I put it up on a blog a couple of years ago. I probably should do so again.
I missed that one. I'm going to have to go back and find it.
Well, I still have it in my original Paranoia box, so I gotta dig. I really should dig that out, and I have the Hill Sector Blues playtest material, which I probably should scan that up. That would be interesting to have people look at and see what was being playtested back in the day. Now that my scanner works, I could actually do that. Holy crap! All right, well, let's go on to the third question, and since you mentioned that when your experience with the basic set introduced you to the concept of race as class. Third question is, how do you feel about race as class? Where do you stand?
I've always been a proponent of it, or at least I've been a proponent of it since I started as a developer. In my private life, I usually go with what my players like, and since most of them, again, were my brothers, back in the day, they liked the racist class because they liked playing their Dwarven cleric. Wait, that's me. They like playing
Oh,
their
that's me too. Holy crap.
they like playing like their elvish, swashbuckler and all their fancy third edition classes, and I'm just there going, yeah, but you can be just elf, and then you can be anything you want because it's just elf. So I really like racist class. I think it gives you a couple little parameters, and then you can just go hog wild, in my opinion. So yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I enjoy it too. I think it again, it depends on A lot of it depends on the campaign setting too. If you're going with the traditional races and traditional classes, and races are iconic in what are known for and as, I think it is a perfect fit. And I also like the way Axe handled it, which gave you races class, but the race as class was particular to that race. So it's a little bit of making it, I guess, a little bit more unique. So,
Yeah,
all right.
definitely.
Question number four. Where do you stand on Save or Die? And I'm not talking about the excellent podcast. I'm talking about the concept of Save or Die in your campaign and games.
In my games, the ones that I run and I play, I'm actually quite against it. I usually turn it into kind of a three thing. Like you have three chances and three turns to save or you die. So it's a little more loose. Like, 'cause I think like when you're in the middle of a dungeon, you're down there, you have no way of reintegrating the player who died. It's not like you're always going to find, hey, you finally find a half emaciated naked person chained up to this wall for absolutely no reason, who perfectly fits the other guy's armor who just died.
Oh, of course.
So you can get away with that sometimes, but not always. So I like giving them that chance to not miss out on the second half of the dungeon or, the crypt or the tower, whatever, that they helped get halfway through and then messed up. Now, if you screw up all three of those chances, you're gonna die.
Right.
But, so that's where I personally stand. In my development, I'm a bit of a bastard. So I have save or die in very interesting places. My favorite story to tell is the second floor of my pyramid dungeon. There is a door, and now everyone is going to know this, where it says on the other side is your weight in gold. And it's locked and it's trapped and it has a magic dampening thing on it so you can't tell it's enspelled. And if you fail to unlock the physical door, like your thief does, or if
Right.
you use a knock spell, it's the only time in the game where the knock spell will be bad, or if you use a knock spell, you will be turned into gold.
Well, you gave you told them right away. And that's when it's okay. You know what? If you, it's one thing if the player turns a corner and steps on a trap and it's save or die. No. But when you give them enough to work with where they can say, this looks really suspicious, and or, wow, this looks really profitable, I'm sure it's got significant protections, then that's on them. And that's when I'm okay with it. It's when it's just thrown out there randomly that I have issues.
Yeah, and
Don't like that.
I've run into that, like a pit, a never-ending pit that you don't know is there. There's no warning. I don't know what adventure that was, but the pit led into a teleport spell that teleported to a different pit, that teleported to a different pit. And so by the time you finally land it was like 100d6 damage. So, that wasn't a save or die moment, but it was an impossible moment to get out of,
Right. Unless you weren't wearing a ring of firefall. Firefall? No. A featherfall. Man, firefall, that would be interesting. Jesus.
Yeah, that would. Works like a feather fall, but it blankets like in a nice little fire updraft. That's what slows you down and covers up the enemies when you're falling. Like an
I
offensive defensive weapon.
Yeah, look at that. I misspeak, and already we're working on game content. I like that.
Inspiration.
Take it when you can. Take it when you can. All right. Well, I'm gonna hit the last question of the five questions, and then we'll do our hex crawl. You came into gaming in high school, or at least you were introduced to it in high school, or the concept of it. What would you at that age think if they could see what you're doing now in hobby? I mean, from going as a teenager, being exposed to the concept of D&D, to here you are, you've got 10 products on drive-through. You've been doing this for a number of years. Pyramid of the Lost King is one of the better adventures I've ever grabbed on the now defunct RPG Now side of the site. But yes, what do the teenager you think?
Well, when I was a teenager, I wanted to be a writer. And I think if teenage me saw me now, he would at first be, "Oh, God, why? You should be doing real writing." But a second would pass and he'd remember what happened with Stan Lee, who did not even use his real name because he wanted to be a real writer. And, rest in peace, Stan Lee.
Oh,
So
yeah.
I honestly think teenage me, after a few seconds of shock, that I don't have Brandon Sanderson or Robert Jordan material out in the bookstores would be pretty impressed because it's not a direction I thought I'd go. But you just said about Pyramid. I've had other people with other adventures. I did Event Horizon for D20. I don't remember the rest of their publishing name. It's a bunch of letters. And people who constantly just like email me, even though I'm down as just a co-writer, I'm like, "Dude, that sanity system is like the best sanity." So it's, I really think teenage me would be impressed about just how much I have managed to touch other players in a philosophical way, and all that. So, although I think he would be wondering why I'm doing something so old, because as a teenager you want the new thing until you discover the crash, and then you want
Oh,
the old
yeah.
stuff.
That's kind of like my son, who he's 25. He's never sat down for an RPG system. Never was something that was interesting to him. He's always more into the visual of video games and computer games, and he could sit down and play an MMO for days, months, years, and all that, but he just couldn't do, even with the VGTs. This wasn't graphical. I'm like, you're missing the point. But his fiance, she plays 5e through Roll 20, so figure that one out. I was hoping she would convert him. It never happened.
That is always the hope. But I'm going to say, after 10 years of marriage, my wife is semi the same way. She now knows what it is. She has play tested with me because I've always found it hard to find groups who want to play test. But she will not willingly go into a tabletop game. And her visual games stop at Mario. So.
No, there you go. Yeah, Rach and I married 7.5 years. Her only exposure to RPGs has been with me and North Texas in 20, I want to say 2013, was my first con since Gen Con in 94. And she went with me with the idea that she was not going to, I had to signed up for some games. She figured she'd humor me and go to maybe like two. But she had plans to, go into Dallas, Fort Worth, explore, use the pool. And I had her in Tim Schneider's Time Master game for her first real RPG session, figuring Tim sounded like a lot of fun playing one of his games. And Time Master was great because I figured nobody at the table besides Tim and maybe myself would have had much experience with it, because I own it. I have the boat box set from the old Pacesetter game days. And within the first 30 minutes, she's putting a four-armed creature into some wrestling hold that even I didn't know what the name was, and she bought in. Now, I'm saying that she bought in. She'll play at conventions. She doesn't care if I'm at the table with her or not. But she won't play at home. Like, she won't hop on a Roll20 and play in one of those groups. But she's all in at conventions, man. I'm watching this, and it's like, not. I didn't know this when I met her and married her, but wow, this is cool.
Nice. I actually had the opportunity to play in James Fane's Dungeon Crawl with her last year at North Texas. And
Oh, there you
first,
go.
I'm really sorry I left her in that room to die, but she was an awesome player. Very imaginative, very gung-ho about it. So, that, and putting it with Tim Snyder, I mean, I've used Tim as an editor a few times, but I've had the, pleasure of sitting next to a table he was running. I couldn't get into his game. Like literally it was full. But he is a really good game master, was really able to bring people in from what I saw. So that was a perfect choice for the first game.
Yeah, that was my whole idea. It's like I knew Tim would be really good, but I also wanted a system that everybody would feel like they were a novice at. I mean, the last thing you want to do, and in my case, it's part of the reason why I put together Swords and Wizardry Light, is that you don't want to throw somebody into role playing with all these experienced players that know the system and you don't, because then you feel like you can't get your own feet under you, and you're always running to catch up, and you never get to enjoy. So I figured with Time Master, I was pretty sure Tim was going to be handling all the mechanics and just explaining what was going on, which was perfect. And my eyes just lit up when I saw Rach get into that. I was like, oh my God, she's having a blast. This is what you want for your family. This is you want to share your own passions. And I was able to share that and watch my own wife totally love it, enjoy it, embrace it. And that was great. It still is great.
Oh yeah, totally.
So now we're off those, we're off the beaten path, I guess you could say. And I have been following your releases for a while, Josh. So what got you into self-publishing and putting your own, basically putting your shingle out, as they call it, and if you were a lawyer, but put your own stamp on your work and self-publish? How'd that bite you? How'd you get into that?
Surprisingly, it was you. I
Me?
joined you, yeah. I was just doing stuff for my daughter, and I was really scared about this one race I made that was kind of complicated for Swords and Wizardry, for my daughter to play, because she's 14 now. She was 6 at the time, and has always been into those anime catgirls.
Oh,
So
okay.
I went and I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna have other people who played Swords and Wizardry look at this and tell me what the hell I'm doing wrong, because I was not certain at all. So I went online, I went to the Swords and Wizardry site, the old Mythmer Games one.
Oh, yeah.
I went to the forum, the forums were down. So I'm like, okay, where else can I go? So I type in, I'm like, Swords and Wizardry, social media, the Google Plus page pops up. So I join and I was, at that point, I'm like, oh yeah, Google Plus, this was 2011, so long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
And so I posted on that. I made it a PDF. I put it on my Google Drive. I posted a link to it. And everyone really liked it. So I started following a little bit for a couple weeks. You were posting daily at the time. And it was the one month where you posted content every day. Like a beer that gives a benefit,
Oh, yeah.
bar seat of a lore. I'm actually making most of this up at this point.
No, I know, but yeah, it's the, I think I had, oh God, like a certain, magical serving tray, the beer bear and stuff like that. Yeah, I
Yeah.
remember.
So I was like, oh, I can do this. I'm always coming to like little tiny magical items, stuff like that. So I made a blog. And I did it for like a year. I'm just like daily posting content. Like that entire first year is like 270 posts on the blog. And 90% of them are, here's a new race, here's a magic item, here's a monster. And then Shane Ward, who I'd become friends with over Google Plus in that time, I was following his blog, kind of contributing sometimes to it, was talking about the 2012 One Page Adventure Contest.
Okay.
And so he did one, and I'm like, I think I can do this. I'm sure I could do. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get it to one page. I could get it to two pages, one front and back.
Right.
And for a couple of days, I was like, oh man, this really, I made this thing, and it really stinks. I can't really share it. I made it for Explorers. Really cool adventure, very inspired by Aliens.
Oh, that the Explorers RPG, which is like based off of like kind of like original, I think. Is that the one I'm talking about?
I think it was.
It was a very simple OSR sci-fi rules.
Yeah, it actually had my favorite. It actually has my favorite space combat system because of just how simplistic it is. But I couldn't. Yeah, I couldn't get it down to like less than a page, so I couldn't submit it. And finally, I was looking around. I noticed RPG Now had started their pay what you want thing.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, well, if I can get a few bucks here and there for this, that would be awesome. It would really help because then I can buy more PDFs.
Right.
So I put it up on that, and in like the first 24 hours, it got like 50 downloads, five actual sales, but 50 downloads. At the end of the first week, it had been downloaded 1,000 times. So
Wow.
just, that of number, of people who were actually buying the thing. And because I had my email in the PDF, I had people emailing me questions. Most of the time it was like, what system is this? But it was still really cool to get emails. So I'm like, okay, well, let's try this again. So I made an OS, a Sword and Wizardry adventure, which was kind of like the start of Ushrum, which is, where Pyramid of Lost King came from. And that actually got reviewed by Swords and Wizardry, not Swords and Wizardry, Save or Die. And it just kind of like went from there, like, each thing built off the other. But yeah, you and Shane Ward are kind of where all the inspiration and the start came from.
I'm speechless. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that, man. 'Cause I love your work. You've got a great narrative voice. And it's one to see. And you make some great art choices for your covers.
Yeah, the covers have always been one of the things I've always wanted to be well done. Inside art, my go-to guy is Frank. I'm going to mispronounce his name, Frank. I'm sorry, Frank Toffler, who's Middle
Okay,
Green.
yes.
He does those maps, and those maps are awesome. But he's always been my main go-to guy for inside art. He's done some of my cover art too, a lot of the black and white ones, but.
Oh, okay.
I initially, I went to DeviantArt. I kind of copied Venger on that. Venger, back in 2011, he was doing his lamination, not laminations, the Demon Blade thing.
Oh God, yes. And V does a great job getting some amazing art choices from DeviantArt for no money down. I mean, really, he's done well with that.
Yeah, so that's where I went because he was talking about how much of a good money investment it was for what he was getting from these DeviantArt artists. So I shopped around. I was very, because the cover on, especially on a PDF, is what you typically see, and is what typically drives your decision to get something because, DriveThru offers those previews. They're not the greatest, and it's kind of impossible to make them really great, especially with a short product that's only
Right.
3 pages long.
You're showing your
So,
whole product in a preview.
yeah. So the cover and your description really have to drive it. So that's like the one thing I always did my best to make sure happened well. And then of course I've for Pyramid I found Eric Quigley, and I was just blown away by what he does. And he's like, it's like if I have the money, he's my cover artist. Because
Quigley is great. I used him for one of the tavern's rotating banners until, of course, my rotating banner code got screwed up and no longer rotates. But yeah, Quigley is amazing, and he's quick.
Yeah, and yeah, I was just going to say that too. He is really quick and he's very communicative. It's not like you give him the thing and then he disappears until the final's done. It's like every he's like, here's the line art, here's the draft, here's
Right.
seven different versions. Pick
My
one.
God, I'm thinking the same thing. Yeah, because with his, with his banner art with the tavern, I got three or four different versions of it. Any of which I would have gone in my eyes went, well, this is like publishable. I mean, these are done. And he's like, well, which one do you like? He's like, I detail the one that you like. I'm like, this isn't detailed.
Exactly. I mean, the first time he sent me, I'm like, oh, so I pick one of the seven, I use that. And he's like, no. You pick one of the seven or a combination of them, and then I detail it. I'm like, what do you mean? This is like professional done already.
Yeah, I know. It blew my mind that the not just the object, just the amount of control I had over the art, and I've commissioned other pieces for my banner. I've spent a good chunk of change between a lot of them, and Eric was the one that gave me the greatest amount of control over the final product, and I almost didn't know what to do with that amount of control. It was scary.
Oh, totally. It's almost panic inducing because it's like, but I gave it to you. I'm
You're
not
the
an artist.
professional, yeah.
Yeah.
You're the professional. I'm just the one that, like, because any of them, well, I would have gone like, "Wow, these are cool." I mean, in the end, yes, you do have a preference, but if I wasn't given choices, I wouldn't have known I had a preference. I still would have been like, "Oh my God, this is fucking awesome! Thank you." You know.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, that's. I
Just a
said,
little
yeah.
aside,
Go ahead.
I don't mean the soapbox here, but I have to say, with my experience with artists, in my makings here, in the last whatever years it has been, they deserve what they, they deserve more than what they charge. I mean, they are awesome. And it kind of irritates me sometimes when people are like, oh, this is so expensive. It's $10. Like, dude, you're getting a steal. Take that
No,
$10 and love it.
and you know what? I feel the same way. And I was involved before I put out, the handful of pieces I put out. I was involved in projects for another small publisher. They no longer exist. I don't think you can pull my old stuff up on Drive-Thru anymore. But I wasn't making that much. The publisher was obviously making the greater share, but when I found out that what the artist was making, I was like, dude, just give my full share to the artist, because the art not only was good and timely, but if I was getting like a 30% of the sale price, the artist was getting 10. And although I am proud of the work that I do when I write, I can't do art, and I appreciate art, and for the time and effort that's put in for what they do, the vast majority of artists that provide art for publishers big and small are underpaid, vastly underpaid for the time they put in and the quality of work that comes back. And I really wish that the hobby could, and I'm calling it a hobby at this point, because if you're not paying people what I think would be a real market rate in the greater world. If we're not paying them that, then we can't say that we're totally professional. You know.
Yes, very much agreed on that.
And I wish, oh man, I wish I could remember the name of the artist that I worked with. Did some great black and white artwork, and this it was my those magic items that I was putting up on the blog. A lot of them got converted over to this product. And like I said, and for me, I was happy to get my stuff out there. But and here's another thing that I've noticed too, is that a lot of the artists that I'm gonna say get taken advantage of or don't get paid anywhere near going rate, don't live in the Western world. They're out in Asia, in Thailand and Malaysia, and they are highly skilled, and they're taking pennies on the dollar for what a lot of artists here are already taking less than they should. And I it upsets me.
Oh yeah. There's actually two pieces in Pyramid. The Egyptian woman in the bikini clothes looks in the bikini clothes, and then the elven explorer girl, like 3 pages later, done by a girl in the Philippines. And when she, when she priced me for it, it was like she wanted, she's like, "Oh, $10 for these." I'm like, "Okay, And then I got the final product. I'm like, "Here's 40. I wish I could give you more." She's like, "No, I only asked for 10." I'm like, "Take the 40."
Yeah, because they underprice themselves, and I understand to some extent why, but it just, like I said, like we both are saying, artists in general, in gaming, whether it's unless you're working for Wizards of the Coast or Paizo, you're not generally getting paid what I think your work should be. And I've bought some amazing originals off of people. And I said this to Doug Kovacs back at my first North Texas RPG Con, because I always loved his artwork for DCC. And I got the chance to talk with Doug. I talk to him whenever I see him now, but I have to talk to him, and I was looking at prices on some of his original work, both pencils and otherwise. I was like, Doug, my personal opinion, your originals are underpriced. He goes, really? I'm like, he goes, I guess, he goes, you're not the first person to say that, but I don't hear it too often. I'll go, I'm telling you right now, I think you're underpricing your original work. Those are one of the kinds. Prints are prints. Signed prints are great. I own many. But when you get an artist's original work, you should be paying what that original art is worth, and should be, generally speaking, a bit more than what a lot of these artists do charge for it. Especially, 8.5 by 11s. You get an 8.5 by 11, pencil sketch of what was a DCC cover for, I don't know, $50. I think that's
Damn.
that was yeah that was, I've seen that some artists have adjusted their prices on their originals now and brought it up, and I think that if people want originals, they'll pay for that. Again, pricing your prints, because prints are not one and done, but original artwork I always felt was underpriced in this hobby or this community.
Totally. At the same time, I got a, monkey, Frank, who I mentioned before, and I'm really sorry, I'll never remember his real name. Monkey Blood. Monkey Blood Design does wonderful maps and the Midderlands.
Oh, Glinseal.
Thank you. Amazing charity, amazing willingness to work. I'm sorry for going back to the Pyramid, but it was like the biggest project I did.
Oh, definitely.
I ran out of money because the Kickstarter barely made it. It made it to $3,100, and then after taxes and fees and all the cards that did not go through, it was $2,200 that actually I got for production. And I ran out of money about 4 maps before it was done. And I talked to Glenn, and I'm like, "Dude, I know I contract you for this much. I don't have the money for it. So I'm really sorry. Can I still use the maps that I already paid for?" He's
Right.
like, "Here's what we're gonna do. You use the maps. They are the named versions with the numbers are yours. But I can use them in my non-commercial works." And I'm like, "Really?" If I could have reached through the computer and hugged him in England, I would have totally done it, because that allowed, that bit of charity there allowed Pyramid to finish. And then Frank took a flat rate for like the last 15 pieces. It was like, it was variable for that. It was like, well, the size of the piece you want, the complexity, and the last 15 pieces Frank took a flat rate for, because I said the same to him, like, Frank, I know I asked, I did this and I prepaid for all this, but I can't, I ran out of money. And he's like, let's work on this. Actually, that's where Event Horizon came from. I was looking to make some extra money for Pyramid, and John Rice, put out this call for a writer for a project. I'm like, well, I'll put the paragraph in, and maybe I'll get it. Maybe I'll get 200 bucks if I get it, because he was offering so much, And then
Right.
I ended up doing pretty much outside of the initial idea in the publishing. I got Tim to do the editing. I found all the artwork for it. We used all Creative Commons and stock art, and then I did the layout for it. And he's like, dude, you finished an adventure in 3 weeks. I wasn't expecting to be done in a final draft for 3 months, and then you took on all this load because I got busy. Here's an extra 200. And I was like, Frank, take the money. So I felt like none of the Event Horizon money, because I kind of split it between Frank and Glenn, just like, here, it's not everything, but take.
Well, and that's something that you're bringing up that I think is, well, it's a couple of things you've brought up I think are very important here. But when you're part of a community, when you've got these connections and these bonds, people step forward and they help. I Swords of Wizardry continue alight. I have somebody who's volunteering to do an actual layout as opposed to my, at best, serviceable layout. That was the best review I heard about my layout skills, by the way. Serviceable. He's gonna, off to lay it out for me and put out a new, I guess, printing of it. And it's because it's community connections, and that I think is something that a lot of the larger players in the industry, like Wizards of the Coast and Paizo, they have this all in-house, where we have it all within the community. And I think that's what makes this so strong, is these connections that, we support each other.
Totally.
And you also pointed out something that I think a lot of Kickstarter creators should also remember too, is that when you fund, people forget this, but when they think, oh my God, I took in $10,000, I've got $10,000, take off about 9 or 10% between Kickstarter and fees for the payment processor, and then you got to take out the taxes. And my minimal knowledge of corporate taxes, but I believe that in order to offset your expenses, you have to take the money in and pay money out within the same year. Otherwise, you're always behind on that. So you can get hit with taxes that you don't expect. And it's a shame, but a lot of people going into it don't realize that. You got a budget for that, I'm assuming. Going forward, you'll remember that lesson.
Yeah, and I don't know if Kickstarter, because this was 2013 that I did this. I don't know if Kickstarter's changed it, but they used to auto deduct the taxes, and they would auto deduct it from the funded amount, not the actual paid out amount. So,
Ooh.
if I made 3,000 and then someone who donated $1,000 at the last minute pulled out, and deauthorized the payment from their credit card, I was still getting taxed at the 3,000 amount, not the 2,000.
So
Now
they
that's
were
not.
withholding. Yeah, you'll get it back at the end, but that's horrible for getting your project out the door.
Yeah. So, I only had, I think, like 300, dollars worth of, credit cards didn't go through, but I was still taxed for that 300. And again, I don't know if they changed
Right.
it, because I complained about it. I know a couple other people complained about it, so I'm wondering if that's one of the reasons they left Amazon, because Amazon used to be their payment processor. And now I'm getting a little too banking.
Okay. I gotcha. Interesting. See, I didn't know that. That's a little bit of a background. It also explains Ken Whitman's numerous projects. I'm sure he didn't take into account that there would be taxes withheld. Interesting.
Well, as a one-time Kickstarter person, I gotta say, you don't you don't you only think about that funded amount, and you budget for that fund. You don't think of any of the other stuff, and it really can throw a wrench into your plans. In terms of Ken Whitman, I would say after the first time, you should have known better.
Yeah, but it is Ken, and just so you, random updates on Ken. Apparently, the foil, I don't know what's the foil press that he had for to finish his pencil dice, which he had pictures of in the fall. I haven't seen any pictures of finished pencil dice, but it's Ken Whitman. I mean, really. What does one really expect from Ken?
Very true.
So now, Josh, what do you have coming up? What do you what's on the horizon?
Well, I took a break from the blog for a year, kind of just to reorientate myself. So I'm really focused on the blog this year, but I'm actually, and I'm looking at now because I didn't close it when I opened everything up. I'm doing a second extra add-on for Pyramid. It's like 2, 3 pages long, using stock commercially available stuff, just because it makes it a lot faster to go. Adventure for Pyramid, kind of extends things out, adds a little more flavor to the setting. So that's the thing I'm working on now. I'm also really trying to get into, to use the word very loosely, activism on DriveThruRPG. I've been harassing them for about 3 months trying to get West End Games's D6 system its own category, because right now it's just mixed in with all the other D6 systems.
And
So
they're very different. I mean, if you're basing it off of the Open D6, it's a different system than even Faraway Land, which uses a D6, but they're totally different resolutions.
exactly, and that's where I was coming at it from, and so I've been on DriveThru's back end about that for a while now, because I am a really big fan of OpenD6 as a whole. It's a very streamlined system that really moves, but when you go to try and get anything from DriveThruRPG, you've got to wade through a bunch of stuff, and you might accidentally get the wrong thing. Unless the actual person publishing it is very clear, this is OpenD6.
Right.
So that's basically where I'm at, just bugging DriveThruRPG and working on a new Pyramid adventure.
So now, are you going to put out stuff in D6, Open D6 later? Or are you going to convert anything over to it?
I have three Ghostbuster ripoff adventures actually already published, and I have plans for a fourth one. But I'm also very back burnery working on converting my original Swords and Wizardry setting that the blog was originally based around, the Celtic Roman themed era, 2D6.
Oh,
And
really?
it's actually the home campaign I use with my daughter. And I'm really, collecting things, and I'm trying to make my house rules for D6 uniform so that they can. I'm not a big fan of balance as it is, but be a little more balanced.
Okay, fair enough. Well, exciting times, man. We got again, I have. I used to follow your blog. I didn't realize it came back. I should obviously catch up on that. But I've been following your work since you started putting stuff out, man, and I've always enjoyed it.
That is definitely high praise coming from you, Tanker. Thank you.
Well, I don't know how high the praise actually is. I'm just saying you do damn good work, and I've always thought it. But I'm just another voice in the wild here. I've. You do good work, man, and you're I always felt that you should be better recognized for your work because your quality is high. So hopefully, going forward, you pick up more More of a community, I guess, more customers, more readers and players of your work. And if people haven't had the chance to look at the Pyramid of the Lost King, it's good stuff. It's very playable. And that should be high praise, because not everything out there is playable. I can name a company that's well known in the OSR that puts out some amazing stuff that is jack shit not playable. So.
Thank you. I mean, honestly, if I would could stand up right now and not like rip off the headphones, I would be doing a Ren and Stimpy level happy dance.
Oh, Ren! God, that's something I gotta like start looking up again. I haven't watched Ren and Stimpy in ages. Not the newer ones, the older ones, the ones that were just horrible. Those are the good ones.
It's very hard to find Ren and Stimpy.
It is. Well, Josh, thank you for joining me this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy we could finally do this. So, I've been looking forward since I think January. So.
Yeah, no, I believe me. That's we've been doing our own Ren and Stimpy awkward dance, just trying to get on the same schedule, same page. And I'm glad we did, man. And I'm still stunned that I had any influence. That's really cool, really cool.
You have like an amazing blog. You've done amazing things. I mean, you are tanker, you know?
I am Tenkar. Yes, I am. The definition kind of the blog has changed over the years, and I guess I really do enjoy creating content. It's I don't think I could ever go back to doing it daily again, even though technically I am retired. But I seem to have a lot more draws on my time now that I no longer have a regular job than I did when I had a regular job. So, but maybe this episode will convince me to at least get back to doing weekly content posts. So, gaming content. I think I'll do that.
That would be awesome. You did good stuff, man.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. All right. Well, at this point, we're going to wrap this up. Again, I thank Josh for spending time with me and all of us. And I will include a link to Josh's storefront on drivethrough.com in the show notes. So you can check out his amazing stuff. Again, Pyramid of the Lost King. I can't recommend it enough. So, as always, God bless, be well, roll those dice, and I will talk with you all tomorrow.